and it gives that credit to the lumber mill, and the lumber mill could pay the tree farm with that credit, and eventually the home buyer would, you know, get by, and the whole thing circumvented banks because they issued credit directly. But if a bank issues a credit, my biggest problem with banks issuing credit is that they actually have nothing to back the credit. The borrower ends up backing his own credit, and he's paying interest on credit that is not based on anything other than his own assets. That always bothered me. So all the bank is doing is certifying the credit worthiness of the borrower and insuring it, and charging a huge amount of money for doing that, as if they had loaned something that was actually theirs to lend. But there's, who's the guy, Tom Johnson, who became the mayor of Cleveland, and he was a big hero in the Johnstown flood because his factory was there and they took charge of the rescue. But after the flood, there was a depression of 1892, and he told his workers that he would that he could stay in business and keep them all employed if they would accept money that he issued to them, and that way he could continue to sell streetcar rails to all the streetcar companies of the United States. And he could do that on credit. And when the streetcar companies finally paid him, he finally paid the workers. But there was an agreement in Johnstown to accept those credits, not just by his employees, but by everybody in Johnstown. They exchanged those credits. And you legally, it was illegal to pay employees with anything other than cash. So Tom Johnson had a window where he paid his employees, and they would walk to the next window, and they would buy as many Johnson stock credits as they felt comfortable with. And then they would give the money back to the payroll person when they did that, and then the payroll person would move that money back over to the next employee. So they paid people substantially with credits, and they had this little dance that circumvented the prohibition against paying people with credits. But that worked, and he paid everybody back at the end of the thing. It didn't make any interest, but it kept everybody employed, and it kept the town of Johnstown from suffering a huge recession. So that kind of thing can still happen, and I see somebody with, like I mentioned Amazon, because I see somebody, you know, if a whole lot of people in the world buy things from Amazon, then if Amazon issues credits, those credits can circulate because everybody can buy, can use them, can redeem them if they want to. Somebody who doesn't have that kind of market would have a difficult time issuing those credits.
I'm going to pass it on over to Mark Young, who's going to moderate. Right, Mark?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, Michael.
And I'll stack again. There was something else, but it's unrelated to what I just said, so I'll wait in the stack for that.
Okay, great.
Do we have an existing stack? I didn't see it.
But we don't have an existing stack. I don't know how you want to do this or what.
It might be next in the stack anyhow.
Well, I mean, I just think that from the talk itself, I think we have to recognize what he's talking about and what he's not talking about. I don't think he's talking about a separate, and the funny thing is monetary reform has not really been defined completely as what it means and what it doesn't mean. There is an issue with, even if I use, I think I agree with Paul to some degree that this type of digital transfer is already going on. I think they're talking about taking out, he's talking about taking out banks as an intermediary and us being free from banks and having to deal with banks. And so if there is this government system that allows them to set up accounts free of interest charges or everything else or monthly banking fees, and it exists as a public utility for people to store their digital money, that is a valid, I think that's a valid benefit or amenity of monetary reform. I do think it's different from what we're talking about, which is how do we use the government's ability to create sovereign money as a tool to eliminate injustice, unsustainability, and other things like that out of the economy. And so they are two different things, but there may be a lot of room to actually, I would say, use that as a push for monetary reform, and maybe that is a second tier of it. Because we don't really talk about freeing ourselves from bank. We just want to kind of limit what they can do and what they can do. Whereas he's talking about, well, an economy can't exist without using banks as an intermediary, which I think can be a very important topic.
Lucille Stack.
Go ahead, Lucille.
Just on your last point, point I wrote in the chat is, you know, it might be wrong, and I understand why you got the idea. He might want to be eliminating banks, but that's not how I read his paper. And in relation to Howard's question about the intermediaries, it seems to me that after the reformies that he and I think we are talking about and advocating, that banks or maybe, you know, other decentralized credit issuing financial platforms, he used the word platforms, they will be able to do so based on how much money people take out of their digital accounts or cash and lend to them, because they have a huge surplus and they want to do that. They want, or because the government will tax that huge surplus at a point in time. And that was my earlier post. But it seems to me that what the banks and digital intermediaries or platforms would do is based on the general money, the digital money, but it's no longer, the banks are not assured. You know, they are making an investment. They have to work as a real bank. And if they lose that money, they've lost their investors' money. And so there will be much stronger, and I would agree with this decentralized aspect, that people will invest. They won't know what some of their money is going to locally and regionally, you know, or internationally, however they want to do it. And but it's at risk. It's not theirs. And if they want to take it back, you know, they have to do the terms of however long they lent it, and then they transfer it back to the digital account. And so the other point I wrote in the stack is a little bit earlier, and it's quoting page 2-3 of his paper at the bottom of page 2, is, you know, he says, money, like we all believe, money must circulate. It is the bloodstream of the economy. And so it was like, well, then if we're all keeping our money in these digital accounts and it's just sitting there for when we need it, it's not acting as money. And that was the thing that jarred me a little. But he then goes on two sentences later to say, with digital cash, a faltering economy can be effectively kept going. And then it's the next sentence that seems crucial. Monetary taxes take away undue accumulation of cash. And then the other side, monetary benefits complement cash deficiency. And to me, that was a huge sentence that had a lot of content to it. And that's what I think, you know, the crux of how it actually will work and the monetary authority. But I didn't see it as banks would be creating some new kind of money other than if you understand, you know, they loan money, they create a bond, and then they sell those bonds. If that's going to go on, they do that, and if people buy into it, they buy into it, but they potentially lose it all too.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Michelle. We got Sue, Bo, then Paul. Go ahead, Sue.
So it was interesting. I came away with thinking, and I don't know if this is true, that the digital cash would be in government accounts, and that cash, only if you wanted to invest it, only that would go to the banks. So the banks would never not have real checking accounts that they were getting fees on, but they would just have investment accounts. So is that right?
I think it's all the above. I don't think he was saying that he was limiting people from not putting money in banks. From my understanding, what he was saying, if anybody can correct me if I'm wrong, that it was giving people the option to decouple themselves from banks. And so if somebody wants to use a traditional bank account, fine. But if you want to hold your money in this, let's just say, government platform or savings accounts or whatever you want to call it, you could also choose to do that. And so if you transferred your credits to, let's say Chase Bank in an investment account, you could do that too. So you don't have to have all your money in banks. You have this other platform that's kind of independent and just your own bank. Everybody, in a sense, can be their own bank. Not that you can create money, but a bank just is like my own institution, is how I took it. Bo, go ahead.
I don't know if I understood it the same way. First of all, somebody was saying earlier that it's not that he supports getting rid of banks. Banks have a role in society. It's the central bank, which would be obsolete. So I want to clarify that. What people are talking about now, what I heard that was that during the transition period, the existing debt money right now in the form of deposits, for instance, would be transferred into one of two things, either as bonds. So these are investments that carry all the risks that that are involved, or as digital cash in your digital safe. And in the original part, it would be like one-on-one parities, like for the last time, so that the claims on bank would have a one-on-one value to the digital cash. So there is the separation between money and credit. Right now, the two are merged. So I'm not sure exactly what, you know, in terms of the technology of where it would be stored, whether it's in, you know, I don't know about that, but I think that's the main thing. It's not about government or banks, but it's about credit and money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was I going to say? I forget what I was going to say. Anyway, okay. You can go to the next person.
All right, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, this is to kind of what Lucille was getting at. I think we have to remember that under the NEED Act, banks will cease to exist in the format they are today. They will no longer be issuing credit money out of thin air. They can still exist, as Lucille was saying, in terms of taking investors' money, and we'll know where our money's going. They'll be underwriting and vetting potential borrowers of this money, but banks will no longer, I mean, that's just regardless of, you know, what technical system we use. I think that's the key. Also, I'm still confused about the focus on digital money, because to me that's just technology which is going to change. You know, in 10 years, you know, look at Bitcoin and say, it's antiquated. It's to me, monetary reform exists. You know, whether it's checks or credit cards or whatever mechanism we use, monetary, it doesn't impact the viability of monetary reform. And the last point is that in terms of needing the government to tax idle money, we have to remember, why are we doing this in the first place? It's not just to come up with another neat system. We want an end to all this. We want people not to feel so in a state of panic that they have to hoard money away. I think naturally people are going to want to spend their money. They're going to not be fearful of the future. They're not going to be, you know, keeping money tucked away under their virtual mattresses, collecting interest necessarily, or at least it'll be reduced compared to what it is now. So I think we can't lose sight of the whole reason that we want monetary reform and the consequences of that, you know, and we tend to think that after monetary reform, the system's going to be the same. We're going to have the same problems and the same, you know, issues to deal with. And the whole idea of monetary reform is to eliminate a lot of these artificially created problems that we're existing under right now.
Yeah, I would agree. I understand your point. I think, like I said, I think the, and I don't know because I'm, you know, I can't get in Edgar's mind, but I think the point is to not necessarily say that this is, I think this is a different track that he's talking about in a lot of senses, is that even though, and I agree with you fully, that monetary reform can exist without the discussion they're having, I think the question is it a good complement, right? And so that it's kind of like the website abbreviations that came out that was instead of Gmail or Yahoo, it was .me, and you can create your own domain name. And I think I equate that to kind of how they're looking at money, and saying that I don't have to go through Gmail, I can have my own domain name. Now, in practicality, that's still going through some other server, and there's still a backbone to it, but to me that was the issue with it. Dan, go ahead, then Stephen.
Yeah, I agree with Paul quite a bit, and I was frustrated during the conversation, and it relates to people saying, well, I think what he meant was this, and I think what he meant was that, which was we asked him very simple, direct questions, and if there was an answer to the question, it was buried into a heavy telling us what he wants us. I mean, it was kind of like he was trying to sell us on it, and every answer to our questions was a little nugget buried into a sales pitch, and it made my brain hurt. the thing that I see, right, is that this is not a technological problem, this is a justice problem. And so the solution is not a technological solution, it's a justice solution. And, you know, we could have done, if we had the political will, we were halfway there in 1862, and we could have gone the rest of the way there in 1862. And it doesn't depend on checking accounts or electronic transfers or anything. We could have, you know, the Romans did this with the numisma in, you know, something BC. So I'm stymied at the notion that we need digital cash to make this possible. The digital cash thing fascinates me, and I think there's some good aspects to it. But I just don't see how it's in any way fundamental to monetary reform.
I would agree in principle with you, Dan. I want to read what Mary put in the chat. She said, because digital has become so big internationally, shows that many people share our concerns about bank privilege and power. Mm-hmm. Integrating digital into our conversation and proposal invites all those people to participate
in the
design of a monetary system. In quotations, need act for the future. I think that's it. It's not really that it's going to change what we're doing, but I think it invites other people to say, hey, along with your desire to be independent from banks, this is a second level of it. And so I think it just opens up other people to talk about it. Go ahead, Stephen.
Thank you. I have like two avenues or two points to make. Or I can put them in one big ball like a Gordian knot and let you have at it. But, and I'm going to try for the big ball. when I looked at Edgar's thinking is, and I'll preface that with Joe, Paul, and Howard, maybe Dan some too, where, you know, what is the difference between electronic and digital cash? And I'll go more or less with the same thing. I think what Edgar was getting to is when we can think of it as digital cash, or you can say electronical cash, since maybe the 1990s more so, or however, whatever date you want to, we want to give to it, doesn't really matter. But he looked at it as a public educational driving force. And the fact that the government can issue big money, you know, they couldn't roll that out to, as part of their public education, because there was distrust in government. You know, that was seemingly how he was ending the conversation a bit. But coming back around to this, and Dan brings this up with the Johnson story of the company created money, he saves his company, and then he goes on to save the whole city using his credit system, and they get around the problem. And the question now is, could banks do this in the future? Could the banks create a local currency much like Johnson did, where they take in the cash, or they give the employee the cash, the employee gives it back to them and accepts credits in exchange, and they go on doing this? Could a bank figure out how to do this and, like, create their own money system out of credit again, doing this going into the future? And I don't think I have quite a definite answer. And I think, too, about this in relation to, is that just, can I call that just a local currency? And how does a local currency, you know, be it Amazon or Sonoma County in California that wants to go on its own little digital credit card system, how do we go forward? So, and I just want to finish with this one main point, and this comes from Yamaguchi and Kumhoff, and they said it differently, but they said the same thing. And this is the main point in the benefit of monetary reform. Kumhoff says the Chicago plan is not an open-ended Christmas tree with just lots and lots of gifts. And Yamaguchi points it out in terms of his GDP gap, in that you don't have inflation when you're putting out money to have people work towards their in full employment, from underemployment to unemployment, underemployment, missed job orientation. Is the government can always issue money to fill that gap. And that's what maybe Edgar needs to add on to his sales pitch in Holland, or we need to make that part of our sales pitch. We don't have a problem with inflation as long as we're hiring people for full employment. And that's part of the backbone, I think, in which we can stand on. I'll leave it there, and I'll let you tease out whatever nuggets you may find.
Howard actually has a quote at the end of his emails. Howard, what's the quote at the end of your emails? It says something about a full and productive society. I can't remember exactly what it is. I can try to find it if you don't know exactly.
Yeah.
Anything.
No, I've got it. It's anything physically possible or socially desirable is financially feasible.
Exactly. That's it.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. That's how you
avoid
inflation.
Yeah. Yeah. And Yana says the same thing.
Right. Lucille, Govert, and then Paul.
So my comments aren't really addressing Stevens. It was just to add to Mary's point, I think was an important one. And I was going to answer Dan's questioning about, and Paul, about is the digital aspect really necessary, inherent? And I think he Edgar made three points, the middle one of which is what Mary wrote, that the internet is what's going on. It exists, and this is an opportunity for us to see the connection and use it. And his first point is sort of in the beginning of the paper, and maybe that's the weakest and the ones that you're raising questions about, but that historically, we can understand the system we have, how we ended up with it, and now digitally, the government is able to do what it relegated to banks to do for its own benefit as well. But his third reason is really the justice reason. And, you know, he raised that the public has no other option for keeping our money safe these days except to loan it to banks in this system. And it's not safe for us. And that is really, you know, the route. And I think the combination of the three reasonings, and maybe I'm not quite getting it right, but it's, to me, it makes sense. And I don't think it's, and he's committed to democracy, to the people controlling the system, not private, you know, this corporation and that corporation, or fiefdoms creating their own little, you know, local currencies for, you know, that they operate. If that goes on, I don't think that what he's advocating would actually lead to that, because I do see the financial institutions and banks being intermediaries for the sovereign money in the land. It's just they're not propped up by the government anymore to bail them out when they mess up. And so they will learn not to mess up.
And to go along with that, I think there are two levels of sovereignty, and I almost don't like that word sometimes just because of the stuff that goes along with the sovereign citizen movement. But we talk all the time about sovereign as a nation, and there is a sovereignty as an individual that I should be able to control my money. And to me, that's really what it speaks to more, is that if I don't want to invest my money, if I don't want to lend my money, if I just want my money in my account that I've earned, I don't see it as a credit issue of issuing stuff like that. But if I have, let's just say, $100,000 in my own personal internet safe, and it's also talking about money as a public utility, that this is kind of a right to have my $100,000 in this thing. And if I want to loan that, if I want to loan Dan $10,000 out of that and transfer it to him, I shouldn't need a bank. Now, we can do that cash-wise, but digitally it makes it a lot easier. And I think a lot of this stuff already goes on now, but I think it's also, there are always intermediaries right now. I can't loan, unless Dan comes to my house and I give him $10,000 in cash, that's the only way he can get it. But the digital question goes to something else, that if Dan is in a whole different state than me and he says, hey, I want to do this, that I have the ability to give it to him directly, just between. It's a libertarian argument in a lot of ways, and that it's independent of any type of government interaction. It's none of your business, that type of argument. But let's go to Govert, Paul, and then Dan again.
Okay, well, yeah, a lot of stuff to think about. My first objection actually is that in Edgar's system, you still have banks able to kind of create credit out of nothing, but it's not denominated maybe in the national currency. It's called a bond. Whoever they, you know, pass on the bond to will use it for whatever purposes, provided others will accept it. So you still end up with a kind of money system based on credit, which still will have systemic risks, depending on, you know, how much they will create. And I can see that, you know, even if you have a lot of little banks just creating these kind of bonds, you can have situations where there is a crisis that, again, still the taxpayer and the government will have to step in to just save the system by somehow bailing out, you know, all these bond makers. So I'm opposed to that. It sounds like that banks become, you know, or that besides banks, there will be so-called platforms that will be intermediaries. But those platforms actually already exist, because that's one of the functions of banks, to be, you know, to assess creditworthiness and extend, you know, money. So I don't see that he takes away the risk, the systemic risk, if banks are still allowed to extend credit in that way. The other thing that I was a little bit taken aback by was that, well, if the monetary authority, you know, has power over that money and can say, like, well, you cannot do anything you like with your money. You need to keep, you know, 30,000 units in your account, you know, you cannot do anything with it. You cannot, you know, gamble it away or something like that. And the other proposal was, well, at the same time, if it's stationary, we're going to tax it away. So I think it gives too much money or too much power then to the monetary authority, where I would say, like, well, if I have my sovereign money and I put it into a bank where they, you know, not as an investment, just as a deposit. And even if the bank goes under, my money is not going to disappear. At least, you know, I don't have the government, you know, to know what I have in my bank account and start messing around with it, because it's, you know, needs to do systemic whatever adjustments. So that's the second thing. You know, there's too much then power to the monetary authority. I did also get the idea that for him, the pushing of this digital cash ID was more an educational tool to make people think differently about how money can be, that it can be, you know, a solid sovereign entity that cannot be willy-nilly, you know, destroyed. I can get his thing that, okay, if you have your own digital account, of course, then you can circumvent the banks if you like to. So that might be an advantage, but it's not necessarily a big advantage. So, yes, I think there is, it gets a little bit too convoluted in his indeed, let's say, the sales pitch. All right, that's my two cents.
Govert, a couple questions. Dusil asked, Govert, who is going to participate in it if it's not secure or usable as money? And also from Howard, if you have money, why go to the bank for bonds, and who will accept them as money if digital cash is the money? Seems like it will be a slow death for the banks, or they would compete more intensely for time deposits of sovereign money. I don't know, do you have a response to those questions?
No, this all things has to be thought through, you know, in its effects. How will people, you know, behave if there is something like digital cash? How will banks behave if they can make bonds? If we want how do you call that, competition? Sure, I think that can be increased with sovereign money, but basically, I don't see a big difference between what we are proposing and what he's proposing, and that what he is proposing is something on top of what we are proposing, and is not a necessity.
Okay.
I'd like to respond to Social Security money. Govert mentioned, just to be fair to Edgar, when he talked about having 50,000 units of money that you kept in your account still as Social Security money, that money can still be spent. It just gets spent on food, clothing, and shelter are things acceptable in that way, and it's not used for gambling or investing at that point. Whether that's correct morally or not, I can't say, but I just wanted to be
like
clear.
Food stamps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, you got your last 50,000 is like for food stamps, etc. It might be only for certain, you know, gambling addicts who have to go down that route or something.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Let's go to Paul and then Dan.
Okay, just a couple of points. As far as personally, I basically only use digital money. I carry maybe $20 in my pocket. I use that to pay to tip the guy at the airport when he takes me to my car. And that's about it. I'm already using digital money. Just want to point that out. The other thing is that I think we have to focus on what we're really trying to change and what we're doing now and what we're hoping to see in the future. Right now, anybody can invest in a mutual fund that lends money for mortgages. You can do that now. It's just not done on a large scale by the average person. So that's not really what is going to be a major change. We can right now keep our money in no interest checking accounts. And it's safe, you know, it's not going anywhere. So, I mean, that exists right now. Those are kind of technicalities. I want to point that out, that it'll be easier and more universal under monetary reform, but we have to bear in mind that we can do a lot of these things already, we just choose not to. And the final point is that, you know, even under monetary reform, we still need regulation. And we never said that it's going to be, you know, a laissez-faire system that's going to run by itself. And I think one way of preventing Johnstown money from taking over is to say that the government, first of all, will not accept that money in taxes. And that's a little nod to MMT. And the other thing is that in court of law, you cannot use that money for damages. You have to use real government-sanctioned money, you know, to pay a claim if you lose a lawsuit. I mean, things like that could possibly be put into place to prevent this kind of shadow banking, as they call it, from taking hold, and the shadow creation of money. There still needs to be some regulation to prevent that.
And Paul, this is a message from Bo. This digital money you are already using now is bank credited debt money, not debt-free money. There's a huge difference. I also think, just to add to that, is that and I could be wrong, because this is the first time I've actually seen him talk. I didn't get the intent that they were talking about like a complementary currency. I got the feeling that he's talking about who holds your money and can you hold it independently of any other institution as kind of a public utility. Now, I could be dead wrong on that, but it sounded to me like he was saying, almost like I was saying with, you know, like your Facebook account is your account and your money is your money. And there should be some place that I can put that without having to deal with any bank, any investment, and I can just hold it there for as long as I want to hold it. Mm. If somebody can, Bo, you've talked to him more than I have. I don't know if you can comment on that, but that's how I took it. So,
yeah.
Bo, go ahead, and then we'll go to Dan.
Even though the form is digital, right now the stuff with credit cards and transfers and money wires and stuff, it's all based on bank-created debt money. With the sovereign money, the digital cash would be sovereign money. It has value in and of itself. It's not a money claim, but it's actual money with value. And so when he talks about, okay, your money when you put it in the bank, under his system with digital cash, it would be very different from the system that we have now. Not getting into the technology at all, but if you have your digital safe and you put money in there, that is yours. it cannot gain interest and it cannot lose value because it has intrinsic value, which is very different from the money we have now. I mean, with my class, I've got Iranians. Their monetary system is going crazy. Their tumans are day by day decreasing in value. So they're seeing their life savings disappear. What used to have this much value has this much value now, and it's going to have even less value down the road. They have no control over that whatsoever. In a digital cash system where you have your digital safe, that would not happen. You would not be at the mercy of the markets. You would not be at the mercy of the currency exchangers. That money is yours, and it would hold value. And you decide how to spend it and where to spend it, but there's such a... You are not taken hostage by the banks, essentially. And that's
to go along with Bo, I think what he was saying about the stability of the economy in an economic crisis goes to exactly what Bo just said, is that if we have our own money in our own accounts that's not tied to any stock market bank, large investment bank, we can continue spending amongst ourselves even in a period of economic collapse. So I think that goes to that point. Let's go Dan, Steve, then Sue.
The couple things. Well, the most recent is if you have a debit card with the bank, then the money in your debit card is not debt money in terms of your relationship to the bank, but it is an enabler for the banks because it helps them meet their reserve requirements to create other debt money. So you can solve this problem just by having the government issue debit cards. They already issue EBT cards, which is the new food stamps. And they could just issue everyone a debit card and put money in it as your share of the new money. And that debit card would function very much the way digital cash functions. The only thing is, when you go to the store and you put that debit card in their credit card reader, some central agency is going to be in charge of transferring the credits from your card to your merchant's card, and from the merchant's card to the employee's card. So all that we want to see done is perfectly possible with existing technology. The other point I had was that with the shadow banking and the Johnstown money and whatever, is that what you receive is not denominated, it does not pretend to be US dollars, it pretends to be bonds and it was literally bonds in Johnstown. They issued you a bond that was interest bearing on the condition that they made a profit. Well, they paid everybody back before they actually made a profit. But the bonds were effectively, in the Johnstown case, 0% bonds. And if a company or a bank issues too many of these bonds and the bank fails or looks like it's going to fail, it doesn't lower the value of money generally. It lowers the value of the bonds. And it actually increases the demand for the money because people are no longer accepting the bonds. So I think if you keep the bond value separate from the money, you have it's the same thing as if the Canadian dollar falls, it doesn't pull down the American dollar. If anything, it pushes it up. And if the American dollar falls, it tends to push up the Canadian dollar. So I don't see shadow banking as a threat because it's not going to be accepted as broadly as bank money that we have today is accepted. And we accept bank money today because we can't tell the difference between bank money and government money. There's no way I can look at the money in my bank account and say this is not the same as government money, because I can go in there and take out, you know, $3,000 worth of cash every day until it's all cash. And the fact that I can do that gives that money credibility. I'm done.
Thanks. Stephen, then Sue.
I didn't know I was on step, but I'm taking advantage of it. Thanks.
I'm sorry. I thought I seen you.
Well, it's cool. No, I'm going. I just to respond back to Dan, and Govert brought this point up.
No take backs.
Okay. No take backs. Say Amazon issues sort of its own credit system, and you call it bonds, whatever. The question would be, and Dan makes this point by using the term broadly, how broadly is it used? And Govert says that by, could Amazon money create systemic risk in a system? And to the extent that government allows it to take place, does government not bear some responsibility?
I don't know if I took it as, to me, if Amazon creates credit, it shouldn't be fiat. Like,
right.
Amazon has $200 billion in the bank. Now, if you want to credit some of that to somebody and give them a $5,000 credit line, then you have $5,000 less than that $200 billion available.
Okay,
to me, that should be the rule. It's not a fiat system like banks have. It's not a fractional reserve system. That's how I looked at it. Now, I don't know if that's what he meant, but that's how I take it.
Okay.
We'll have to ask that question.
Well, fair enough. And that tends to go along with the idea of having a local currency, too.
All right. Sue.
I'm wondering if everything that Edgar said, if it when he says digital cash, if we substitute debt-free money, because I understood that the bonds that would be bought by the depositor is basically equivalent to our NEED Act investment account in a bank. So basically, he's talking about the same system, except he doesn't have a revolving fund. So on this transition that he was talking about, there's no analysis for us, or maybe for the public, I don't know if he's done it for the public, about when the nature of the money changes and bank credit goes away, how will the banks have enough money to continue the economy, expand, you know, growth? And that's my...
I think, and I can't explain from his standpoint, but from my standpoint, I see a couple of things is that I think he's talking on a micro level, whereas we're always talking on a macro level. And I think what he is saying is that if, let's say a startup wants to raise money, that they have to figure out through our digital interconnectedness, how to get people to give him money directly from their own personal accounts. I don't think it's necessarily about, to me, he's talking about something almost not totally different, because I understand how what we're talking about enables what he's talking about. But I think what he's talking about is really your ability to save as a public utility is something a little bit fundamentally different than what we're talking about, even though I do think they go together. So for instance, like I said in the example before, if I have $100,000 in my own personal account that's not attached to what a bank does, right? A bank is going to measure risk. They're going to do underwriting. It's similar to the stock market in a lot of ways, except for I'm still not going through intermediary. Like if I choose to buy Amazon stock, which is $2,000 a share or something crazy like that, and I say I want to buy 5 shares, I have to transfer money to some stockbroker or something like that, where I think he's talking about a much more independent kind of libertarian system where you're free from anyone, almost like a public utility of money. I could be wrong, but that's kind of what I took from it. Okay, I don't think we have anybody else on the stack right now.
I'd like to make a short comment.
Go ahead, Bob.
Something you need to know about Edgar is that he's very active in the political field. I mean, he works as a corporate lawyer, but with Ons Geld, after they had that very successful play that they collected over 120,000 citizen signatures to trigger off a parliamentary investigation into the banking system in the Netherlands. I believe that report is coming out this year. I mean, he has talked extensively with politicians and parliamentarians, not only in his own country, but in the EU. So his contact with policymakers, with politicians, with central bankers, is at a level that we're not at yet. And I think for him to say, you know, the stuff that he said about, you know, raising public awareness about how having a debt-free system will unleash, how did he say it, the spending powers of the government, he also said that had no traction. So there's something, it's not just an educational thing. There's something about what he does that I know of that is very much in line with, okay, how do we sell this? How do we get more people on board? How do we get more support, not just from the ordinary person, but from legislators and politicians and central bankers to actually make this happen? And so I want to just clarify that it's not just an educational exercise that he's doing, but he is, you know, putting ideas out there and then coming back and trying to rephrase and reframe so to have a better reception for these ideas.
Okay. Stephen, I think, then Dan. I think Dan has...
No. I'll let Dan go. He's suffering. I can tell.
Go ahead, Dan.
The thing about the shadow banking is that it requires a great deal of repression to stop it. I mean, can stores not issue store coupons? Can you not give your store coupon to somebody else in exchange for something? You know, there's a lot of inevitability in shadow banking, and I think the main protection of it is to keep divorced from it, that you keep your money divorced from the shadow banking, and that protects your money. The point that Bo just brought up about the selling gives me a chance to plug what I've been saying all along, which is that people are skeptical of when they say, we can just create money and spend it on the things that we want. I think people are skeptical of that. And as long as we're providing full employment, there will be no inflation. Well, full employment means hiring people who are less productive than the private sector would have hired. And you're going to be making jobs for them that may or may not be jobs that increase the goods on the market. When we talk about, you know, we're hiring people to build or maintain or improve roads, for example, the money in circulation can't buy roads. So that is actually inflationary. And until the market responds by saying, now that we have these roads, we can build more factories along the roads and do what we need to do. So I have a lot of trouble with the idea that we talk about increasing the money supply in order to spend more. I think that we're on sounder footing with the public, and I think economically, if we talk about creating money so that we can tax less. And then there's nothing to prevent us, once we've done that, to come in through the back door and raise tax rates anyhow, and then build the same roads we were going to build. But there is more of a budgetary process involved there. I've noticed with local governments, when they get federal money, it's like, well, this money's available and we don't have to face our own taxpayers to spend it, so why don't we just spend it? And doing all sorts of stupid things like financing stadiums and stuff. They do that because they don't have to answer to a taxpayer for the money. And I think most people are afraid of giving government the power to do something on the promise that it won't be inflationary when that promise is, that guarantee is not them making a guarantee, it's us bearing the brunt of the guarantee. So that's my
Understood. I think the only part I will push back on that, Dan, is that I do think that, one, every part of society is not about creating goods, right? A lot of it is maintaining stuff. So if I'm painting a yellow stripe on a curb so people don't park there, that can be just as important. It's not a good.
Denying that at all.
Right. So I think that's a large segment of what people could spend money on to get to that full employment, and it wouldn't necessarily be dangerous. I do take your point. I agree with it on some levels. Go ahead, Steve.
Let me put in a plug for next month's Monetary Coffee House. It's on this point. Mishy will be talking from Hungary, and the whole communist era, socialist era system was putting people to work. And the conversation comes around value, and do you create value when you have 500 jobs when you only need 300 people to do the work, but you end up having 500 people? I think in the NEED Act, or when I tend to push in the daily conversation with new people how to make it successful, is that, you know, government, as we have 25% in the NEED Act, goes to state governments right away. Governments, municipal, and as money is coming through the system, there's choice, and government can send a contract out to the best private bidder to dig at the yellow stripes paint on the curb or the roads built, etc. And you know, you can create sort of a competitive what we're now going to call a one-tier banking system. But this whole conversation, I think, will come up again next month. Mm-hmm. I had another point on Dan, but I'll just stay with one point right now. I'm going
to
shut
up. I think to go along with Stephen said, I talk about this in some of my writings, is that if people don't have jobs, if full employment is not something that we strive for, then you're always going to have government support through taxation in some kind of way. And so is it better for me to make a full-time wage and work 20 hours a week? Or is it better to have somebody else working 40 hours a week and somebody else be without a job, but yet we got to support them through taxation? To me, it's better for people to have lower hours of work and more free time to spend with
After reading your book, I'm going to write that in my diary, Mark, about you talking about government taxation. I just let you know.
Maybe we can have a coffee house on the basic income and new money.
Yes, I think that would be a very important one.
Does anyone know anyone who you can recommend? For the basic income.
Carl Weiderquist spoke at the Georges Conference.
So maybe, why don't you forward his information to me, and I can approach him. Sure, that's a great idea.
Okay. Well, it's 1:20. We've been here for a while. I have house guests, so I need to attend to them to some degree. Does anybody have anything else they want to say or get off before we end the call?
I liken us to a world-class Major League Baseball team winning the World Series. I think we're just a great group here, and it goes along with Margaret Mead saying it's a small group doing powerful things, being concerned that changes the world ultimately. And I think this is a great gang of people.
I would agree fully.
I would echo that as well. I'll just say there's a lot that has come up at this coffee house to process from Edgar and from our internal discussion. So if people want to put out, a specific thing that they'd like to ask Edgar, I can collect those on the email chain for this coffee house and see what would make sense.
That would be great.
Continue that conversation and have them on down the road, definitely.
Yeah, about that educational piece and where the citizens said, oh, government created money, you know, that's crazy. But there's a way to go about educating that. And Sue Peters sort of suggests it when she talked about that revolving account, the NEDEX revolving account brings up a natural conversation.
So maybe you can type that into the the email chain, and I can forward that to him. That's great.
Yeah, there's another piece to that too.
Great.
Let me just thank
Bo Young for organizing these coffee houses. They're so good. So excellent.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, everybody have a good weekend and a good next week and a good year, whatever. And we'll
like
talk to each other soon.
Okay. See you on Friday.
Oh, you actually have to end the call. I can only get off because you started the call, so you have to actually end the call.
Okay, bye.
Everybody take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.